This morning I'm talking about the passage that Rose read, which is from the end of Mark chapter 8, which has been chosen because it's the lectionary reading for today and traditions that follow that, and that's easier than coming up with something myself, usually. It's slightly more than the lectionary reading because the lectionary reading felt like a piece out of a story that was a bit longer. It's a crucial turning point in Mark's Gospel. It's literally the halfway point. In a 16-chapter Gospel, the end of chapter 8 really is the halfway point. And it turns the tone, it turns the attention from Jesus, the itinerant preacher and miracle worker. They really turn towards Jerusalem and the Passion and a different sense of what's going on. There's enough content in these 11 verses for a whole series of sermons, and for a whole swag of Christian doctrines and cultural assumptions of various value. My approach is going to be to go through the passage, making some comments as I go. It won't be comprehensive. And then I'll have a look at some questions that's raised for me. For those who are not into a half-hour theological exposition, or who have come today juggling multiple things, or who are sitting on the blanket at the back with children, there's a few points where I'll just have just a couple of pieces I'll repeat for you to just hang on to and sit with, and just feel free to just do that and ignore everything else I say. I'll alert you when one of those bits is coming. I'm going to start with two quotes because I couldn't find a way to put them in, and when I read them out to Tyson this morning, he said they were too good, we had to use them. The first is from, they're both actually from Dave Bland, quoting someone else. The first is quoting Dallas Willard, who talks about vampire Christians, which I thought was just magnificent. Christians who want Jesus for his blood and nothing else. I just loved it. And I couldn't find a way to put it in, so there you have it. The other one was from Mike Cope, who said, Christians need to stop surveying the wondrous cross and get up on the thing. So, we'll start from there. The story picks up, the immediately preceding incident is the healing of a blind man at Bethsaida that takes two goes. You might remember the story. The first time he says, how are you doing? He says, oh, everyone looks like trees walking around. So he puts some more mud on, does another bit, and then he can see properly, which sets the scene for themes about blindness and seeing, partial blindness, having some of the message, not having the whole message, maybe I've got it, maybe I need a bit more help. That's what's come before. And then we get to Jesus and his disciples left for the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he put this question to his disciples, who do people say I am? And they told him, John the Baptist, others Elijah, others again one of the prophets. But you, he asked them, who do you say I am? Peter spoke up and said to him, you are the Christ. And Jesus gave them strict orders not to tell anyone about him. I'll stop there for now. This is a bit for those who are only listening to the small bits. Who do you say I am? Who do you say I am? Not just what you think about at 3 a.m. on sleepless nights when you can be really honest with your spirit, but who do you say Jesus is to others and to yourself? Who is this Jesus? Who is this Jesus to you? Thank you, Dr. The incident takes place at Caesarea Philippi, which is right in the north. It's nearly into Syria. And it's a town that had long been the centre of pagan worship. It was a Baal worship place. There was a huge temple to Herod. It was a centre of worship of the god Pan. It was also a Roman military post from which they had incursions into Palestinian territories. So it's a very interesting location for the revelation of Jesus as the Jewish Messiah. and the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. It's a pagan site. The responses from the disciples about the crowds, clearly they know he's special, but they just can't place him. Elijah, a prophet, something, but it's out of their grasp. The Greek of the question, who do you say I am? In Greek, you don't need to have pronouns to make the sentence work. So I and you and he, the verbs carry that without it. So when they put the pronoun in, it's because they're emphasising it. And it has the pronouns. It has you and I. Who do you say that I am? And the you is plural, so it's talking to the group. Who do you as a group say that I am? The evidence that the disciples have to work with to answer the question, they've seen an itinerant preacher of some wisdom, integrity, and unusual authority. He's a miracle worker, especially with the poor and the outcasts. And he preaches about the kingdom of God in a way that stirs up a following among the rural poor. That's what they've got. And the question is, who do you say that I am? I'd like to talk a little bit about the social hierarchy of the culture Jesus is in. And I'm using the work of Herman Wedgen, if you want to look up and check. The bulk of the population are rural peasants, and they're very poor. Probably up to 80% of their produce was taken as tax and rent and forced labour, which leaves them on the sort of a dollar a day kind of existence that we know we have now. Very, very poor, but able to mostly get by. Above that, you have anyone involved in the religious hierarchy is above the peasants. Anyone with any power. Almost all the urban population is above that. Household servants even come in above that. Below the peasants, those on a dollar a day, are the artisans, which include carpenters. These people are poorer than those who lose 80% of their produce in unfair taxes. Poorer are the artisans. Many so poor they can't afford to get married and have a family. Which raised for me the question, was Jesus a single man because he chose to be, or because he was so poor that he couldn't have a family? Even lower than the artisans are those of degraded occupations, those who use their body for their work, either in prostitution, but even those such as miners or tanners or shepherds, those who are physically labouring in a way that their body is the thing they sell, those who are involved in work that is unclean, shepherds come into that, miners. And then even lower are what Herman Wedgen calls the expendables, the beggars, the vagrants, the thieves, the outlaws, lepers. They're in the realm of malnutrition and possible starvation. So that's our picture. Messiah, in Jewish terms, the Messiah would be at the top of the hierarchy, would come at the top of the religious, political and social hierarchies. Jesus came lower than a peasant and then reached himself even lower than that. So what does Messiah mean when Peter says, you are the Messiah? And Peter sort of represents the whole group here. He's the voice, but he shouldn't be made to be the fall guy. They're expecting a political figure leading a military force, taking the top place, overthrowing the Roman occupying armies. There's also some expectations, not with everyone, of an apocalyptic figure coming to judge Israel in the end time. So it's a leap for Peter to say Messiah about an itinerant Nazarene preacher with a rabble rural following. It's a big leap, but it's not big enough. Peter seems to say the right words, but Jesus' response is more than terse. The word that gets translated as He gave them strict orders. He told them sternly not to tell anyone, is epitomeo. And it's also translated in other places, rebuke. It's the same word. But we don't have an English word that has that sort of force, both for warning someone forwards about something not to do that way and looking backwards at something they've done and telling them off. We have it for telling them off, but it's the same word for looking forwards and telling them. So, epitomeo. Jesus epitomeos them not to tell anyone that he's the Messiah. Usually in Mark, epitomeo is used to talk about demons, Satan, possession, and exorcism. And Jesus' response to Peter here is really very similar to in chapter 1, where a demon says, I know who you are, you're the Holy One of Israel. And Jesus epitomeos him to say nothing.
I don't want to stay with Dada.
She doesn't want to stay with Daddy, excuse me. And you need to stay with Daddy, okay? Or you need to go in the background. All right? The force of that is somewhat lost to us in the way that we hear all the Gospels together. Because in Matthew, when Peter says, you're the Messiah, Jesus says to him, well done, you're blessed, on this rock I'll build my church. And we sort of hear that into this story. But in Mark and Luke, Jesus turns and epitomeos him to stay silent. So, goes on. Then Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man was destined to suffer grievously and to be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and to be put to death and after 3 days to rise again. And he said all this quite openly. Then taking him aside, Peter tried to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said to him, get behind me, Satan. You are thinking not as God thinks, but as human beings do. This is the first of 3 predictions Jesus makes in Mark of the Passion, which increase in detail. And it's definitely not how you want your leader to see himself. But Jesus is clear and unambiguous. This is not parables. This is not a partial revelation. This is not a half healing of the blind man. But Jesus, there is no shame for him in pronouncing this, which is possibly to be compared, we'll get a few more verses on, to where he talks about, will you be ashamed of me? The prediction includes suffering, death, and resurrection, as do all 3 predictions. It seems they didn't hear the resurrection bit. But do we? Doctrines based on this passage emphasise Jesus' suffering and death as the reason for the incarnation, but they're less clear about his resurrection also being an inextricable part of the reason for Jesus' time on earth. Peter's response now makes it clear what it seems Jesus knew the first time when he said Messiah. Peter might have some of the words right, but he has no inkling of the significance. Jesus is so dramatically not Messiah, as Peter understood it, that he's not recognisable as the Messiah at all. Peter's words to Jesus are a restatement of the temptation in the desert. Will you be the Messiah? Will you be the one who takes it by power? He gives this, now it's in the mouth of his disciples, the opportunity to be what they expect. And Jesus recognises it for what it is and says, get behind me, Satan. And again, uses that word epitomeo. And Peter is used, that's what Peter's trying to do to Jesus. He's trying to say that to Jesus, and Jesus turns it back to him. Peter takes Jesus aside for a private word to clear things up. But Jesus rebukes him in front of all the disciples. Now, we can have a smug assumption with 2,000 years of hindsight that Peter should have known better, as obviously we would. But do we want a suffering Jesus? Now, if you're only listening to little bits, this is another bit for you. What sort of Jesus do you want? Right now, in all the corners of your life, what sort of Jesus do you really want? When you listen to the world news, what sort of God response do you hope for? When you are outed as a Christian amongst your secular friends and families, workplace, what sort of Jesus would you like to have standing beside you? When Jesus says he must suffer, die, and be resurrected, how does this fit with the Jesus you are hoping for? I would suspect that the idea of God suffering with us is part of the theologies of many of us in the room who've wrestled with injustice. Jesus clearly suffered, but it is a comparatively recent development in Christian theology to wrestle with the idea of God suffering. It's a post-Holocaust theological development. Only with the Holocaust did Christians have to say, maybe we have to think about God differently and come to the idea that God may suffer with us. So if we're thinking about Jesus' disciples, they had no model of a suffering authority figure to hook into. Suffering and death were failures. And supposed messiahs who could not avoid suffering and death were ridiculed. And if you pick up Glenn's work on Mark, he talks about a comparative example of the same period, who claimed to be the messiah but then was killed in battle, and how he was absolutely ridiculed and scorned, and all his followers also. The radicalness of suffering as God's chosen path for Jesus to bring humanity to wholeness just cannot be overstated. Even now, with 2,000 years to try and integrate it, it's still radical and disturbing. We can't begin to imagine what it meant to Jesus' friends and followers. The story goes on. He called the people and his disciples to him and said, "If anyone wants to be a follower of mine, let him renounce himself and take up his cross and follow me. Anyone who wants to save his life will lose it. But anyone who loses his life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. What gain then is it for anyone to win the whole world and forfeit his life? And indeed, what can anyone offer in exchange for his life? For if anyone in this sinful and adulterous generation is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him or her when he comes in glory with his Father with the holy angels." Just in case predicting his own suffering and death was not enough to completely destroy all they thought they were following, Jesus takes it further and tells them that they're in for it too. And this section is addressed not just to the disciples, but to the crowds. One temptation for me is to read it and think, the disciples are clearly no hope, as he turns to the crowds and says, anyone willing to do this? But actually, I don't think that's what's going on. I think it's the call to discipleship is not just to the inner circle, but to all of us for all time. If anyone wants to be my follower, my disciple. This expands the lakeside call, follow me, and gives them a bit more detail of what exactly they've said yes to. Follow me becomes follow me to the cross. The cross is not a jewellery item in first century Palestine. It's a known and visible form of the death penalty. And it's used for the lowest of the low, those classified as non-persons, especially slaves, vicious criminals, and political dissidents. Some of you probably know the work of Ched Myers, who's a prominent theologian exploring political and social meanings of the Gospels. Ched Myers asserts that crucifixion was used only for political crimes or crimes deemed a threat to the political order. Once you were sentenced to crucifixion, you had no rights. To strike somebody on the way to their crucifixion carried no penalty because they were already legally registered as dead. You only picked up your cross once you'd received a death sentence. No one was wandering around with crosses just in case. So even metaphorically, to pick up your cross meant to become as one already dead within your society. And in the reality of Jesus' day, it probably meant literally that to follow Jesus would get you killed. The cross is not a metaphor for the difficulties in my life. We each carry our own cross. Or, oh well, I guess that's just my cross to bear. It certainly wasn't then, and it minimises the impact of the original to use it that way now. Now, to us it might seem that the reason the cross was reserved for the worst of the worst was because of its torture, terror, pain. And Mel Gibson's The Passion movie certainly is our preeminent example of emphasising that in our culture. But in Jesus' time, the horror of the cross was not its pain, but its shame. It was significantly designed as a form of public humiliation. So Jesus' invitation to discipleship is not, it will hurt a lot, but you will be shamed and cast out by your society and then killed. There's a play throughout this passage on denial and confession. They're invited to confess, who do you say I am? And Peter confesses, you are the Messiah, but then denies Jesus' version of the Messiah, denies the suffering Messiah. Peter's given the opportunity to deny himself, but instead he denies Jesus. Jesus says to the disciples, to all the crowd, to be a disciple is to deny self and to confess me. I'm not using confess there in the sense of putting your hand up and saying, yes, that's me now and then, but in a whole of life sense of, this is who I am. So the question becomes, do we deny ourselves or do we deny Jesus? And it's put as an either or here. There's no middle ground. Do we confess ourselves or do we confess Jesus? This piece of the story also has the resurrection clause. And it's perhaps as easy to miss here as when Jesus uses it to predict about himself. I think this is Jesus expanding the prediction about himself to apply to the whole crowd. I will suffer, die and resurrect. You will suffer, die and resurrect. If you lose your life, you will gain it. And this talk about the Son of Man coming in glory, the bit that's given is, and I might be ashamed of you, but it implies that, and I might not. There's something up Jesus' sleeve for the followers when the glory comes as well. There's something there of resurrection also. This is a call to follow Jesus. Not his teachings, his wisdom, his miracles, not his tradition or his church, his attractive disciples, his poetry, his music. The call is put to the disciples, who, represented by Peter, have just totally failed to understand Jesus. So clearly, you don't need to get your ideas right in order to follow. It is in the following that we learn who we are following. That's probably the most important point today, so I'll say it again. It is in the following that we learn who it is we are following. It is walking together. It's not passing an entrance exam to an elite club. Discipleship and the person of Jesus are intricately enmeshed. You cannot have a theoretical understanding of Jesus. It has to be relational. Which brings us back to the start of the passage. If it is Jesus we are called to follow, who is this Jesus? So the thing that this most strongly raises for me is, why would anyone say yes to this Jesus? If you're only listening to a little bit, you might like to tune in again for a while here. Why would anyone say yes to this Jesus? It's the most unappealing invitation imaginable. We consider those ready to die for their religion crazy extremists. We consider Christians willing to die for their religion. I deliberately separate myself from them when I talk to people and say, well, some Christians are, but we're not all like that. And I also help my Muslim friends to do the same. My lovely, peace-loving Muslim friends, I will find myself saying with them, some Muslims are, but we're not all like that. And yet, this has the call to be prepared to die. Why would anyone say yes to this Jesus? I prefer Jesus as a complement to my life, not a replacement for it. The sort of Jesus app for the smartphone of my life. An optional extra or a bonus pack. Why would you say yes to this Jesus? Will you be ashamed of this sort of Jesus? Embarrassed? Will you be less prone to clear speech? It says very clearly, this bit is not a parable, this is clear speech. If you're asked about Jesus, what will you say? Who do you say I am? Will you say Messiah or some 21st century hero figure equivalent, because Messiah doesn't mean anything to us now? Or will you say cross and resurrection? Why would you say yes to this sort of Jesus? Why have you? Or is your Jesus someone else? We all make Jesus in our own image. We cut and paste the bits we like to come up with a Jesus that fits okay. And Peter does that, and Jesus doesn't chuck him out. He works with that. Are we also willing to have our cut and paste self-image Jesus challenged by travelling with Jesus? What does it mean to lose your life and in so doing save it? I'm going to talk about some things I think it's not. I think it's not abandon hope, all ye who enter here. Although at first reading I have to admit that was what I got to. I think it's not trudge through enough muck and you'll be happy later. I think it's not life on earth will suck, but heaven will be great. I think it's not if you have poor self-esteem, a poor sense of your own person, you're a doormat to the whims of others, God will reward you in the end. And I think it's not a call to aim for martyrdom, literally or metaphorically. So things I think it might include, and I have to say, this is a tangled web of difficult stuff, and it's not a nice answer. I think it might include Jesus' message is upsetting to all forms of power. If you follow closely, you will be upsetting power. Power doesn't like being upset. You will get hurt. Now that's not mindless suffering, but the consequences of loving resistance to power. Loving, some people would say non-violent, I prefer to use loving. I think it's a tangled web of motivations. Sometimes I'm motivated by some sort of self-sacrifice, and it turns out quite well. So next time I'm motivated by the fact that it turned out quite well. And I can never have a pure motive. I'm never going to be able to really deny myself because myself travels with me. I think there's something of the mystery of Jesus' topsy-turvy vision for the world that means that what seems a loss of everything will turn out to be a transformation beyond our imagining, a resurrection in the midst of our losing and suffering and dying. I think it will mean that you will forever live with the tension that pursuing your deepest longing means losing hold of the things you want. And that probably is very euphemistic, what I've said. The plainest way I can say it, the Jesus way will change you. The changes might hurt like hell and feel like death. You will not regret it. You will regret it. All at the same time. Whatever you lose, your very self included, you will be companioned by Jesus. Just to be clear though, as Peter found out, Jesus is not some friendly buddy to cheer you on. He might sometimes do that. He just might be rude to you, ask impossible things of you, humiliate you in front of your friends, and tell you that your opinions are evil. So, this is just a terrible tension for me, basically. And I don't have a good answer myself to why I've said yes to the question. The nearest analogy I could find is around parenting. And I apologise to those for whom parenting is not part of your experience, because I couldn't think of a more universal analogy, so please bear with this limited one. The deliberate choice to let go of who I am, to dive into sharing with God the bringing to life, and then to the fullness of life, another human being. I liked who I was before I was a parent. I liked her very much and I miss her. And I grieve that I will never regain completely who she was. And choosing to have a second child has been a step even further away from reclaiming my before parenting self. And I have to say, from this far out, I can mostly see the cost of this choice. The sleep deprivation, physical pain, loss of freedom, inability to hold an adult idea together for more than about 90 seconds, total loss of control. I really struggle to remember the wonder of participating with God in the miracle of life. Let me share with you this to make me cry. Our baby yesterday. It's the already and not yet. It's fully alive and complete, and yet unable to survive alone. Perhaps this is what Jesus was offering his disciples. A grainy picture of coming new life. Shalom, the kingdom. Fulfilled incomprehensibly in Jesus' life. And yet the catch is this baby has got to get out somewhere, which will hurt, and then needs 2 decades and then some of self-sacrificial nurturing. And the kingdom of God is perhaps not that different. And perhaps this ultrasound picture is like What we 21st century Christians with the luxury of 2,000 years of reflection and hindsight are able to see of the kingdom of God. And what Jesus' disciples was offered was more like what women of my mother's generation were given. Little more than nausea, kicks in the gut, and maybe a heartbeat through the doctor's stethoscope. And can you imagine if you'd never seen a baby? And this is all you had. That's what they had when he gave them the invitation to participate in the coming kingdom. It's the invitation to the miracle of participating with Jesus in bringing God's dream for the world to fulfillment. The reality check that goes with the invitation is that nothing will be the same again. And a lot of the time, we won't like it. Jesus came for the least of these, to bring good news to the poor. He came as one of the poor, and then he sank even further, to the very bottom of his society, the place of non-people, and then had the most shaming death his culture could create. He calls us to join in that descent, to be one of the least, one of those closest to his heart. Jesus, not Buddy Christ, but suffering, died, rose again Jesus, calls us to follow him, close to his heart. Will anyone say yes to that sort of Jesus? Will you?